Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello everyone, it's the Matron Page App podcast episode 3. We are joined by a very special guest, Mr. Jamie Carragher. Jamie, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
You're no strangers to the podcast game these days.
Yeah, jumped in. See, well, I thought if you could do it, I could be a bit.
Do you know the most annoying thing is you're fucking better than us and we've been doing it for about 10
genuinely
years.
Genuinely does my tits in, like, you mean. Better the footy than we'll ever be. He then just steps into our broadcasting world and just basically smashes it. We're going to kick things off as we always do with the page. We'll start with Chris Pajak. Have you got anything that's been particularly doing your head in?
My body. The whole body. Like, I've got a clicky ankle, which is doing me head in. I played footy last night, so I'm in absolute agony.
I can't
lift this arm above there anymore.
Are you playing offside trap or something?
I don't know. My back's fucked. Like, absolutely fucked now. The base of the spine, something to do with me discs and stuff like that. I've got a duck arse as well. I've got a duck arse. So every time I'm walking around, my arse is waving at some fucker behind me, which is doing me head in. I've got Christmas hams for thighs and my calf are as big as my 3-year-old kid. So basically, if I can just purge my whole body, that would do. And my eyes are shit because I need glasses as well.
Yeah. You've already purged your eyes on a previous podcast, but it's a laundry list of complaints.
And not only that, I'm losing my fucking hair. And the barber's mentioning it to me now. Like, as she's doing herself out of business, she's going, you won't be coming here for very long, will you, Chris?
I think every man is terrified of that moment going in the barber's and they do the bit at the back and you're just waiting for them to say, you're like, is it all right? Is it all right? Is it all right? And then, you know, and they don't mention it and you're like, are they just being nice? But the fact that, oh, so barber's genuinely mentioning
and she started saying to me, do you want your eyebrows doing? I don't even know if I've got eyebrows, to be honest with you, but she's asking me about it.
We were saying before, like, but the thing is, you've got the baby face thing going on, but everything that's going to stay young forever, and everything else is going to age
Milky
around you.
Yeah.
There you go. That's what it was called in school. Thanks for that. That was brilliant. That's probably what everyone on social media will now call me again.
Absolutely. I wonder if I can dig out a photo of you from around that time because you were very blunt. I'm absolutely.
Is that the one with the Everton kid?
Jesus Christ.
That was later in life. So you've seen that photo?
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, we've had conversations about it.
You still get people stop you, don't you? What game were we at?
What happened there? What was it about?
My brother's a blue. So it was a bet with him. And remember the AJ Derby in like 2005, 2006, something like that?
Oh, I remember that one,
geez. Yeah, so the thing was, we were watching the game together. We don't normally watch the derbies together, obviously. And he basically said, well, I can't remember who, you were there, weren't you? Who said that?
I was there the day, I don't know, I wasn't there for the bet, but I was there the day you had to wear I took the photo.
Yeah.
Yeah, he took the photo. It's outside his.
So basically, if Liverpool would have won that game, your brother would have had to wear it. Yeah.
Liverpool. And then normally we were going to the pub back
then. You come to me, mum and dad's and hid to watch the game. And then the second we won, didn't we? And you binned it off straight away. But we had to take a photo for evidence. And you don't think about these things at the time because it probably would have got on
and
Facebook.
Then when you become an international superstar, it comes out.
And now all the lids. The amount of people have gone, we were talking about him on the coach and we were like, is he a blue or is it a brother? Because everyone now you've now told the story enough that, but it gets like Chinese whispers. So people are like, "It's his brother. It's not him. It's his brother. It's a photo of his brother." It's like, no, it's you. But it was a regrettable.
Oh, it's so irritating.
And you're smoking on the photo as well. I think so. It's like
and the jeans are
look
terrible.
Like you're losing your hair on that one.
I know. Well, there you go. Maybe it's hanging round. So I think I'm wearing like flared jeans almost, and they're really like washed out. I'm more pissed off about the jeans than I am the Everton shirt, to be honest with you. The jeans are terrible. Like,
I've never worn an Everton shirt. Like, you know, because it happens, doesn't it? You go to footy when you're a kid or whatever, and
you know, it happens. You have to wear another team. It's weird. I've never worn an Everton shirt or a Man United shirt.
You've worn a Chelsea shirt. I remember that.
Yeah, I got forced into doing that for a thing. I've worn all kinds. I used to own all kinds of footy shirts when I was a kid. I had like a Leeds United shirt from like the Tony Yeboah. Yellow and blue striped away shirt.
I had Newcastle shirt with the star on. That was a belter kit, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That the Chris Waddle, Peter Beasley one. Oh, the later one.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That would have been like mid-90s, Les Ferdinand and all that.
Yeah, that was a belter team, that wasn't it?
Yeah, so I'm going to take up your page on the body thing because I was going to do something about like not being able to relax and needing to plan how to relax because I used to do fuck all every day and I was great at it. And now I get a day off and I stress out about how to relax. But I'll have to say that because basically, as I was explaining to the lads, I was with a trainer this morning. And I've done my back, and it's the idea that
is this podcast about you or about me?
You mainly, isn't it?
Fucking hell!
I've just bombed to get in. Not
you'll get your turn. Jesus Christ.
You get an hour.
Itching to get his page out.
No, what you want to do?
Stevie kept interrupting your story. That's what it is, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. That was fucking brilliant, that.
No, so I'm going to page me low back. And I'm sure you'll probably get this more. Having been a professional athlete, that living doesn't get any easier. Like, there's come a point where once something hurts, it hurts forever.
Yeah.
And having a bad back, why? That's not fair.
Well, I was supposed to do the half marathon with my brother. He got me as a Christmas present. He does marathons all over the world. And I've always thought it'd be good to do it. But I thought I couldn't do the full marathon. I'll do the half marathon. So I started doing a bit more running. I can't do it because my calf feels like it's going. I've never pulled a muscle playing football. I've never ran that long. You think of football, it's always sprint, stop, jog, whatever. But actually running for an hour non-stop, that was getting me up to about, I don't know, 7 or 8 miles. I can't actually get there.
I'm up to about 1.5 after an hour.
Fucking hell.
That's what I mean, being a footballer, talking about things and that. I just feel like my calf's just going to ping.
So have you got anything lingering left over? So when you play now, what hurts the next morning the most?
No, well, it's only when I do the charity games stuff. I go to the gym most days, so it's not a problem. But it's twisting and turning. Everything's straight lines now, isn't it, when you go to the gym and that. But
do you use that to shine on the other lads? Because speaking to Robbie Fowler about it, and he just said he can't play on hard surfaces anymore because he's ruined because of his hips and all that kind of stuff. So do you do that?
I'm all right playing. It's the twisting and turning and stuff like that now. But I didn't have any massive injuries.
Absolutely does my head in. I'd never physically exerted myself anything like. I mean, bloody hell, you did both. You're cramping both your groins in the Champions League final. Like, I've never, nothing.
And then still won the sprint to the keeper.
Yeah.
It still gets me to this day. It's one of the highlights of watching back that final is you going down, getting up. And having to go and then going down straight again after it, absolutely, absolutely incredible. Although I always thought that for someone sprinting at the end, I thought Harry Kewell moved peculiarly quickly at the end of that, at the full time whistle, for someone who'd hurt himself so badly.
Leave him alone.
Nah, no.
Champions League winner.
Yeah, of course he is. Hello, everyone. Just a little word from me that this podcast is brought to you in association with Threads for Red, the best gear for Liverpool fans on the internet right now, whether it's t-shirts, sweatshirts or hoodies, and they've even got mugs and hats. The quality of this stuff is absolutely phenomenal. You'll have seen me wearing a number of their items over the last year or so, but what they've done is they've relaunched with a load of fresh, brand new designs. You will not find these anywhere else, and they've also upgraded the materials that they use as well, meaning this is a genuinely premium product. This is not disposable clothing. This is top quality gear. It's comfortable, warm, and also looks absolutely amazing. I'm sure you'll agree. For those of you watching on YouTube, I'm trying my best. Make sure you head over to threadsforreds.com. Go and have a little browse, have a look, see what you like, and get involved because it is the absolute best. Right, okay, well, we'll move things on. As mentioned, Jimmy, you've stepped into the podcasting world, the greatest game. What was it that made you want to get into all that stuff?
Well, to be honest, we do the TV, got a paper, newspaper column, and it was just another part of the media, if you like, that I thought I could do. But I didn't want to speak about myself on it. I wanted to try and be better at asking questions and getting people on and a different type of stuff rather than, as I say, we answer questions all the time on the TV, Monday Night Football. And sometimes you worry about the fact that maybe people sometimes don't want to listen.
Yeah.
as much for me because I'm always giving an opinion. And sometimes I think it's nice for me to try and get an opinion out of someone else or dig a little bit deeper. And to be fair, if you were asking the questions, I know it's harder for you to get something out of them because mm-hmm. you don't know them, you don't have a relationship, as I have with Stevie or Michael or the people who came on. And also, I think when I'm dealing with a footballer, they know they can't fob me off with an answer that maybe they could fob you off with a little bit. That's just a fact. So I think you can get a little bit more out of it. And I love the fact that the people I've brought on get a lot of positivity as opposed to me, really. People say it's a great podcast, that's brilliant. But really, it's about the fella who comes on or the lady who comes on and try and get a good interview.
I thought that Henri one, the Henri one was the first one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I thought that was absolutely outstanding because the thing is, obviously, you've worked with Henri at Sky and stuff, haven't you? But you don't get to see
physically slightly more intimate with Thierry Henri.
You don't get to see your personalities a lot on the Sky programmes and all that that you do. So hearing him talk to you an hour about his experience, I always think back to that, was it Take the Ball, Pass the Ball, the Barcelona Netflix one?
Yeah, I watched that, yeah.
And him talking about like going to Barcelona and how he was basically told to just keep making a frigging run over and over again to free up space for Messi. And that, having that knowledge and then listening to him talk to you about it, and the way that, because you know them, because you've got a relationship with them, you just disarm them. Like that Steven Gerrard interview, Steven Gerrard has spoken to nobody on camera or anything like he spoke as honestly. And there was a point where about 40 minutes in, he were F-bombing left, right and centre because I think he just forgot it was being recorded.
Well, that's what he said to me after. He said that was good, that wasn't it? You know, he enjoyed it when it finished. But that's, I think, why you get more stuff from people, because when you do an interview for the paper, if you like, there's like a tape recorder, there's still a journalist in the room, there's, you know, they're still a little bit weird, or there's a camera there, you're doing an interview with Sky. I think people just naturally just tense up. Yeah. If there's someone else in the room, as I said, there's a camera. But when you just sat there, it's almost like Big Brother. You know, I know this is going to go out somewhere, but after about 10 minutes, it becomes just like you sat watching a match, or you sat in the pub, or whatever it is.
Stevie's an odd one, I think, in that. And I say odd one, he is who he is, and because of who he's been and his status, I think. And I've found that because obviously I've interviewed him a couple of times down the years, and he is quite a standoffish kind of guy because I think he's so aware. And I think all the top level athletes are like this because he knows that anything he says can be, it's news, isn't it?
Yeah.
You see it with Klopp a lot now. What was that like? Because you obviously, he's your mate, isn't he? You know what I mean? Did you have that first 10 minutes where you're doing it? And because he is quite cagey at start. Mm. Was there a point where you're thinking, oh, come on, mate, just let it go?
I think the way we do it, we always start with the same question and finish with the same question. And the first question, like the first game you've been to, and it's almost like a warm-up,
yeah,
really. And there's no doubt, you speak to anyone who listens to the podcast, the last half an hour is always better than the first half an hour. And that's like any interview you do or anything you do. It's just people need to sort of warm up to it and get into it. But the thing I want to do on them as well is when you're interviewing Stevie, I don't want to speak about Istanbul.
Yeah.
He's spoken about it a million times. He's probably bored about talking about it. There's nothing new he's going to give. It's more different things.
Is it automatic when you've probably got your set way of talking about it at this point? You know, people are not getting anything more interesting or emotional.
There's nothing new. There's nothing new to say. There's nothing someone's going to say that they haven't heard before. So for me, I find that boring. So I try to find out other stuff. There's management stuff now and his style of management and different things like that. And to be honest, sometimes it's a bit, you have the questions there and it just see where it goes and just, you know, sometimes it going different ways, different things, and there's always something you forget to ask, isn't it? You know yourselves or whatever, or you miss something out. But no, it's good, but it's just how often we do them. That's the thing, because I don't want it to be do too many and then the quality goes. I'd rather just, we've done a series of 13.
Yeah.
I think we're just going to, we've done it, it's gone well. I think what we're going to try and do is sort of the start of September every year, we're going to have a series for September, October, November, and that's it. And then it starts again next September. So it's just getting the guests.
No sound. But so what I thought it was interesting, the Michael Owen one was probably the one that I think surprised a lot of people. Mm. You know, Liverpool fans, you know, you've been a staunch supporter of him, ultimately, as your mate. And, you know, so you're gonna see, you know, have his back more than most would. But I think he came out, that was probably the first time. Because he's done, I think he did Sy Hughes' book. I think he's interviewed in that and he got his kind of point across. And it was interesting because Torres came out, did the same thing and actually came out loads better with Liverpool fans off the back of some interviews around then. But it's probably the one where it changed a lot of people's perspectives on it. It was probably the first time he probably got his
got his side across, and I'm not saying he totally converted everyone, but did you go into that thinking I'm gonna do my mate a favour here, or because he tries a few like oh this, and you call him out on quite a couple of things, so you didn't soft serve any questions to him is kind of what I'm saying.
No, listen, I didn't do the interview because I was trying to help him as such, but I knew it'd be a good interview. When you're thinking of ideas with the producer, you think, well, who can we interview? I said, Michaels will be brilliant. I tell you, it'll go. I know the questions that Liverpool fans want asking. I won't sidestep nothing. And it'll give them a chance to really open up. I think the brilliant thing with a podcast as opposed to a paper is, and you said about Simon's book, that was great. I think when you hear someone's voice,
yeah,
rather than, you know, you see a Michael Owen quote about something, and you say, even if it's exactly word for word what he said on the podcast, I think when you hear something in someone's voice, it feels a bit more intimate, doesn't it? You almost feel the pain, really, in him or whatever it may be, whoever's speaking. Really. So that's what I think is a big thing from a podcast, I think. Certainly the best thing for him, Michael, rather than... He's been on FCTV before.
Mm-hmm.
He's spoken in books and magazines.
He's the club ambassador, I think, which is the thing that I think has probably riled a lot of people,
yeah,
down the years. The club have got a lot of time for him. We were talking about this. I did a video on the Premier League Hall of Fame thing. He'll be in there. You know, and there's a chance he'll be in there as one of the first clutch of Liverpool players because of maybe Man United as well, like, but because of his status in the game, he gets forgotten. But he was an icon, an absolute icon.
He was, and you forget about it, really. And that's the one thing that always, not frustrates me, it's almost nice for me in some ways, that when he came through, he was a superstar, and I was just trying to make my way in the game and come on sub and whatever. And I end up getting a send off at Anfield, and he's coming on sub at Stoke. It's just, you think, how's that happened? And he just regrets a lot. And the reason about being the ambassador was, I just think he's desperate to be loved,
yeah,
by Liverpool. Is this a chance of him getting back in with the club and mixing with people and whatever? But he knows it'll never be, he'll never have the situation I've got or Steve, because he made his decision. You've got to accept that. You know, he made decisions. And then it was almost one bad decision. And then because you're trying so much to come back or to appease people, you make another bad decision. And it was just a knock-on effect, really, where, you know, listen, the Man United one. I think if he didn't go to Man United, I think he'd be all right.
Yeah.
I think he'd be eventually... You look at Torres now. There was a lot of, you know, stuff with him at the time, but now I think you come round, probably last season with Luis Suarez in the Barcelona game, everyone wants to kill him. But give it 6 months, 12 months.
Yeah.
People will say, he's leaving Barcelona, we'll all be on social media, would you have Suarez back? Yeah. You know, it'll all that kick off. The Man United one was the killer for Michael.
Yeah.
That's the one that's really, really probably put him in the position he's in. But I'm glad the podcast, you know, changed people's minds. But listen, it could have made people's minds worse.
Yeah.
You know, that was, yeah, you know, so, you know, I think Michael came across well. But as you said, we didn't fudge any of the questions, called him out on things, and he was as honest as he could be.
Did you know, I mean, the one thing that you could tell there was pain in his voice, it was him talking about he knew he was over at 19 almost, or 20, I can't remember what age it was. Did you know that as a Liverpool player alongside him?
I knew he wasn't the player he was, that was just obvious. You remember watching him, and he'd come back from an injury, and the ball would get put over the top, and he'd go to sprint, and he just put the brakes on,
yeah,
and you knew then, you think, oh, he was still a top player because he was still a great goal scorer. So he didn't have that pace in 2001,
yeah,
but he was still a brilliant goal scorer, really. And then I think, you know, injuries he's had after that coming, and then he'd lost something, I think, around about 2003-04, really lost something, I felt, around the European Championships and the season before. I mentioned that on a podcast where Barros had just sort of in some ways exploded at that Euros.
Yeah, he was the top scorer, wasn't
Yeah,
he?
Now Barros didn't have his goal scoring, but he had a great tournament, he scored goals, top goal scorer, but he was quick and he was sharp and he was that, and Michael was almost looking like a 28, 29-year-old footballer at 24.
Yeah.
Really, where it was just, he looked a little bit, you know, nothing was sharp, nothing was quick, everything was sort of one pace. If you give him a chance, he'd still score.
Yeah.
But it was almost, the game was moving away from that type of player of, like, he could just stand up front, you give him a chance and score.
Yeah.
He needed more than that. So, yeah, that was the same for Robbie Fowler.
Yeah.
In a different way, in terms of, Robbie didn't have Michael's pace, but injuries, different things off the pitch, he was never quite the same. They were at the best as teenagers, and you know, it's sad, really.
Well, what about, like, if you're in the squad and you can see players around you who are maybe not as good as they are, what does that do to you? Do you start thinking, oh, these lads need to be replaced, or... because obviously you've got these relationships with them, and you've grown up probably, Robbie was a few years ahead of you, so you've seen what he's done in the game. Are you sitting at the back thinking, we need to get another forward in, or are you going, I really just want them to come through this and change the game, and I know that they've got the skill set to do that?
Well, there's a difference between whether you think someone's on the wane or whether this is just a little bit of a bad spell, really. And if someone you think's on the wane, I'm like a fan, whether he's my mate or not, we've got to win. We need someone better, or whatever it may be. And I'm sure people were saying that about me when I was getting to the end of my career, but you don't say it, obviously. You don't say it. You don't say it publicly. You always defend people. But in your mind, you'd be thinking, we need to win. We need to be better. They need to, it's life. It's football, isn't it?
Was Daniel Sturridge a bit like that? Because I find, because some of the stuff you say when you're talking about what Michael's like, it reminds me so much of those couple of seasons. It might have been a little bit toward, was it right at the end of you? Your playing days when he joined, but he also had that thing. He reached that point where balls are getting played over the top. Torres had a little bit actually his last season where he's going, and they're not flat out. And you do, because you're giving everything and you're at the peak of your powers or whatever. Is that you can't help it, can you? You must get frustrated.
I remember putting a ball over the top for Torres at Goodison and he never ran. And me and him having words at half time. I always remember I was right back and someone was closing me down. I didn't have any options. I put over the top, and normally Torres was one of those players that you'd make a bad ball into a good ball, and it wasn't a great ball, but normally Torres would just, he'd get there, or he'd put someone under pressure, and he almost like, he'd started walking around. But I think he knew he couldn't do the runs as much.
Yeah.
He'd had hamstring injuries as well. I think this was early on in Roy Hodgson's time as well. And I think it does get like that with strikers. I think Sturridge was the same. I don't think Sturridge was ever the best at, he wasn't someone you seen flying all over the place. Yeah. He was very, to be fair, economical with his running, shall we say. Sturridge, he always played between the penalty box.
Yeah.
His record, goal scoring record, was fantastic. But when he was with Suarez, he didn't need to do that. Mm. Suarez was doing that and running all over the place, really. And I don't think Sturridge was ever that player. So when he got injuries, he was always that sort of staying between the width of the penalty box, really sharp, in and around. He's a brilliant footballer, but he was never going to play week in, week out. You knew straight away Klopp would never fancy them. He just didn't, because of obviously the injuries and whether he was prepared to play, really. And play, I think Klopp said a quote about he's got to know what real pain is or something. Now, it's harder because everyone's different.
Yeah.
Everyone is different. My thing was I had to be 100% injured to not play, whereas Daniel Sturridge had to be 100% fit to play. Yeah. That was the difference. And you actually think, even before Klopp came, one thing I look at, Sturridge is on the bench in that Chelsea game where we lose the league. I mean, what a season the team's had.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't got a clue why he was on the bench. Mm-hmm. He obviously a knock. I don't know if he played the week before or what it may be. But for me, I wouldn't have missed that game when I set up break one leg. You know what I mean? It's just like Chelsea, if we win this game, we won the league. So they're the different things a manager has to deal with, really, the different things mentally of players, how they deal with injuries, how you deal with them about their injuries. Really, so it's not easy, really. But a lot of our top strikers did suffer injury wise. I mean,
was that something that they set up with the club, do you think, or was that just bad luck with the players that were doing?
Listen, I think looking at Michael and Robbie, I don't think sports science had fully kicked in then. I think they were just overplayed, if we're being totally honest. Yeah. I think Robbie's were impact injuries of a knee injury, wasn't it, and a broken leg, I think, early in his career. But I think the cruciate ligament, I think it was against Everton, a game I played in. I think that was. Robbie was never the greatest athlete.
Yeah.
So for him to then come back from that as well, he was always going to be a great goal scorer, finish if he put the ball in front of him. But as I said with Michael, when he lost his pace, the game was changing where you couldn't have a striker just stand up front and score. Yeah. There needed to be more in his game with that. Maybe later on with a Torres or maybe a Sturridge. Listen, any injured player would always point at a doctor or a physio. Am I coming back quick enough? Am I getting the right advice? And, I was never really in that position for me to criticise people.
You're talking about sports science not being in and around football then, but then I think down the M62 and the way that Ferguson managed gigs, and he was always resting him when he was coming through. I know maybe slightly different. They had Lee Sharp in there before gigs, didn't he? And obviously he plays his position, was an amazing footballer. Did you ever look across down the road almost and think, well, these lads, they're all right doing it, and they're bringing in the class of 92 and they're looking after their lads and we're overbearing. Is that think maybe there's something there with the club, because they're not at the peak of Manchester United are they just striving gambling with everything that they've got?
Yeah.
The big difference was our local players and young players who you're talking about were the best players. Man United's class 92 weren't the best players.
Yeah.
They weren't. And I have this, I don't have, it's not an argument, but the class of 92 were not better than what Liverpool brought through. They weren't. They just had Schmeichel, Cantona, Keane, Pallister at the back, Dennis Irwin.
Oh, he was a player, wasn't he?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is Liverpool didn't have those players when those young players were coming through. They didn't. And if you think of the Roy Evans era, who's the two best players? Who's the two players you think of, Roy Evans era?
Farrell and McManaman.
Exactly. Who's the two players you think of, Ulie? You think of Michael Owen and Steven Gerrard? And Rafa Benitez. Well, Rafa Benitez, hopefully you'd think of Steven Gerrard and me.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I'm not saying I was the best player, but what I'm saying is the real dominant figures of those times were the local players.
Yeah.
Our local players were as good as anything any club would bring in the world, when you actually think about it. Michael Owen's going to a World Cup. McManaman then leaves and wins two European Cups. Robbie Fowler's winning two Young Player of the Years. Steven Gerrard goes on to be the best midfield player in the world for a time. So what we were doing at the club in terms of bringing players through was fantastic. It was actually the signings that were the problem.
It always felt like there was just too much burden placed on too few players.
But that's what I'm saying. So the burden wasn't placed on Man United's class of 92. Yeah. When you talk about the class of 92, of being the leaders of that team, they're probably in their mid to late 20s. When they are
when
senior
they take
pros,
over,
they take over. You know.
Do you think that's why the treble season was so good? Because that was probably the time when there was so many good players around there, you know, probably around the squad. You know, even like Marcus Babbel was probably one of the best right backs in the world around that time. You had Gary McAllister coming into the side. You had, was that around the time Lippmann was floating around? Or was that slightly after? Yeah, you know, you had we just had tons of good players all over the park.
No, I agree. That's my favourite season, 2001. Much more than 2005 as a season. I think it's when I say the best team, probably 100% the best squad.
Yeah.
The four strikers we had, Robbie Fowler, Heskey, Michael Owen and Yari Littman, that was as good as anything in the world.
Yeah.
At that time, it just was. But no, you're right, that was the one where you had that good mix of us coming through youngsters, and it was probably the one team where you had a Gary McAllister experience, but people like Sammy Hippie, I think it was about 26, 27, Stefan Ensho, they were, without being the senior pros, because they were still new to the club, only been there a year or two. But that was at a time where you had that nice balance of sort of young and you know, old players.
Yeah. I wasn't going to ask you about this, but what did you make of the Anelka stuff? I mean, obviously we signed him in for a loan period. He plays, was it 6 months or something in the end? And then, obviously, I know what your opinions are on De Jong, so I'm not going to question on that. But did you think that Liverpool should have signed Nicolas Anelka after that?
Yeah, I think they should. But I think what happened was when they brought Anelka in, they brought him in for a loan period. I almost think, in Gerard Houllier's head, it was always a loan. There was never any feeling of he's going to stay. I can only say that now afterwards because you think he couldn't have done that much more than what he did, so why didn't he sign?
Yeah. Mm.
So I almost think it was like, Anelka's a bit of a problem, but 6 months is not going to, you know, it's not going to cause that much of a problem in 6 months. Yeah. He'll come in, he'll do well, and then we can just move him on.
Was he ever a problem while he was there? Because he had a bad reputation, didn't he?
You know what? I don't know. I've heard players of bad reputations, and Elke, none. He was just a quiet, I don't even think I spoke to him really that much. He was just really quiet. He'd come in, he was a classy footballer. He could have played with Michael Owen because he could have played deeper.
Yeah.
He was that good of a footballer. I think he actually wanted to play almost number 10 in Elke in some ways. And I think of Craig Bellamy coming into the club, you hear all these stories, you come in and go, I don't get what the problem is, mate. Yeah. I work with Roy Keane now on TV and you hear all these stories and you read things, I'm a bit like, it's fine. It's just a normal fella. I don't get it. Maybe the way people are with me, or the way I see people, or where I've grew up. I mean, there's a few tasty characters where I've grew up, and I just, you know, there's all different people, and I don't get it. Maybe these people, and Elka's at Liverpool, so maybe he's going to behave, or Bellamy's coming. It's the biggest club he's played for. Maybe he's going to tone down how he is. But yeah, they've got something about them, but the way people talk about these people, it was mad
because as fans, like, losing Robbie was heartbreaking, but at least bringing Anelka in filled that number 9 shirt. Then, obviously, we all watched the World Cup. I just didn't want to talk about it, but I just think it's interesting, the comparison. Diouf has that brilliant game, doesn't he? I think Senegal play France in the opening game of the World Cup, and Senegal are amazing.
Him and Salif, yeah.
And you know, we I think Liverpool fans were all rubbing their hands together, going, "Wow, we finally gone and got the start of a tournament, etc."
We got it done beforehand, didn't we?
Yeah. Before, so, yeah.
And he comes in, and he scores on his debut as well.
I think home to Southampton, the second game.
And it looked the business looked like we'd done a great thing, but was he? What was it? Because his career never ever got better than.
Listen, he just wasn't. Sometimes, when you bring players in, people say, "Oh, what happened there? Or what happened?" it's a little bit like Balotelli, when Balotelli comes in and they got this reputation. And sometimes it just boils down to, they're not that good. You know, that there's no like, Balotelli, people talked about him, whatever. He's just an average player.
Yeah.
Diouf was just an average footballer. He just wasn't, it wasn't that we weren't getting the best out of him. We saw him every day in training. And he actually had a spell playing right wing in front of me where we won, we beat Man United in the cup final. He probably had a 3 or 4 month spell, but he did really well on the right wing. He wasn't scoring goals, but you could give him the ball. He was really strong.
Yeah.
He'd always keep the ball for you. He didn't have much pace, really. Didn't get many goals. He just was what he was.
Yeah.
He wasn't, you know, we shouldn't have bought him. He wasn't the level of, he was a level below Liverpool. He was probably a Bolton. He went to Bolton, didn't he?
Yeah.
And done well at Bolton. That's probably the level. Bolton at that time weren't bad. He was probably a top 10 Premier League team. That's what he should have been. He was playing at a level that he wasn't right for.
Do you know the Balotelli thing? I used to sit literally the row behind the subs bench for two seasons. I think one of them might have been your last season. Certainly it was Stevie's last season, thinking about it.
Yeah.
And Balotelli, he was there and he wasn't watching the game. He was just fucking around. Like, and he gets a chewy out of his mouth and lobs it at the players on the other team, subs bench. And I'm like, oh, you fucking tit. Are you having a fucking laugh? Like, and there's like, I can't remember who the young lads were. And you're like, what are you doing, lad? What are you doing? And then I'll always remember Raheem Sterling's on the bench one game and Andre Wisdom was on the bench. And everyone's singing You'll Never Walk Alone and Wisdom whacks Sterling, goes fucking stand up, and Wisdom's belting out You'll Never Walk Alone and Sterling stands up, and I thought, that's the character that you want on a bench.
Yeah.
Not some lad pulling a chewy out of his gob and fucking lashing at another sub over the other side.
The Balotelli stuff's mad because I think the best performance he ever had at Anfield was at that charity game that you and Gerrard had, where he played in that, and it was like he was like a Harlem Globetrotter. He was just shooting from 45 yards and all that, and you're like, okay.
I've only seen him have one good game, and I'm deadly serious. I'm not trying to, you know, batter the lad, because I couldn't quite get this thing about everyone throwing up. I'd watch him for Man City. I remember him playing at Anfield once. I think it was John Flanagan's debut, and he got brought off, John Flanagan. Yeah, it was a night game. I think Andy Carroll might have scored two. He had a great shot from outside the box, I think. And he played left wing and Mancini brought him off. He was all.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Awful. But the only game I can remember him playing well in was a tournament in Italy, and it was a semi-final against Germany, and he ran onto something. He had a great shot and he scored, and I thought, oh, that was the only game I've ever seen him. I just think, I mean, the way people talked about him, the clubs he went to, played for, probably the Zoe's made as well. Good luck to him, you know what I mean? Cause he's fooled them all.
You must see plenty of players, though, who were like, they've either got it in training but not got it in the match, or they've got it in
Monday
the match.
Monday to
but
Friday
not
player. Yeah. Yeah, there is players like that you're watching in training and they look the part, and then they haven't got the personality to sort of transfer it to a match. And someone who's completely different was Didier Mann.
Yeah.
If you saw him in training, you'd never pick him.
Was he shite?
Yeah, but he just wasn't bothered. He just, he almost looked like he just didn't want to be there. He just got out of bed.
Yeah.
Really, but then on a Saturday, he'd turn it on type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Let's move things on, because obviously you moved out of football, you moved into broadcasting, you're on Sky. I thought it was interesting you talking to Gerard on the podcast, because obviously he's now in management. It's going quite well for him at Rangers and what have you. And you even brought this up, is that I think every single one of us looked at you and went, well, he's going to be a manager.
100%.
He's going to stay, you'll be in coaching or whatever. What was the thinking? Did you
plan to go into it for a short spell?
No, I planned to go into it. I got to 30 and I thought I'm either going to do TV or I'm going to do coaching. And I dipped my toe into both. I'd done my B licence with Conor Cody's age group, I think Wisdom, John Flanagan, so they were about 15 or 16. So I went down and done my B licence, was going there once or twice a week. And I'd done the European Championships in 2012 for ITV. I didn't get the bug for the coaching. It was almost like when I was driving there, I'd be like, oh God, just get this out the way. Now, a lot of people say to me, the B licence isn't that enjoyable, but as you go to the A and then the pro becomes more. And sometimes I regret not pushing on with it, not to become a coach or a manager, but more just for my own knowledge and speaking to people and meeting people, really. But I really enjoyed the TV. And then I think Sky saw me on that. And then I announced I was retiring. But no, basically, I announced I was retiring because I'd agreed to join Sky. Basically, because I knew, I told Brendan Rodgers I was finishing. The club didn't offer me a role, which I am not complaining about. Mm. Liverpool should not be about jobs for the boys. It should not be. But I wasn't going to move my family, my kids in schools, to be a coach somewhere or whatever, really. And basically, the way I looked at it, I was going to the top of TV, which was Sky and Monday Night Football, and watching all the top games, or I was going to start low in coaching, whether that was taking the 23s at Liverpool or taking the under-16s or moving to another club. And I was thinking, I'm quite lucky. This role that's being offered here. And again,
it's the prime time role in football.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Monday Night Football is the best show on TV.
And it's not the best show on TV because I'm on it. It's the best show on TV because of the concept, because it's not every week. So when it's on, you go, Monday Night Football's on. If something's on every week, you get a bit like, you become bored of it a little bit in some ways. It's special that it's we do about 15 or 16 a year, and it's a 4-hour show. It's just like, it's proper football stuff. I also retired when I did. One, because I wanted to get out with Liverpool and go out my head held high and not stay too long. But also people like Frank Lampard, Rio Ferdinand, Danny Murphy, people who I knew would be good on TV were my age.
Did that really come into it?
A little bit. I'm not saying I retired from Liverpool because of that, but it was always there about, I got an offer from Sky. Okay, we're all going to retire around about the same time. If I stay another year, one of them might retire, one of them might get that gig. Listen, there's only probably 10 full-time pundits in this country, if you think of Match of the Day in BT, people who you see regularly on the telly, people dip in and out, but people who you go, right, Gary Lineker, Shearer, Danny Murphy, Match of the Day, maybe Jermaine Jenas, you think of BT, Joe Cole, Crouchy's doing a bit, Rio Ferdinand, me, Gary, Souness, Jamie Redknapp. Roy Keane now. So 10 or 12 people. But I knew Danny Murphy would be good on TV. I knew Rio Ferdinand would. I knew Frank Lampard would. They're all my age. Danny's a year older than me. And it was a bit like, this will also give you a little head start here.
Yeah.
In terms of, getting your nose in into the punditry world, if you like.
Do you miss the competitive side of football, though? Because, I mean, you watching you on the field, you know you're a competitor. And you knew that you went out there. Now, obviously, you love football and you love watching as much football and analysing it and all that. Do you miss the competition side of things? And do you ever think, at some point, what you've got right now might not
Or is doing suffice? Little races with Gary Neville every now and again on
Neville Carragher. I don't, to be honest. I mean, sometimes I look at it and think, I used to be in a bad way if we lost or hadn't played well. It used to really hurt me. And almost when you won was like relief. That you could enjoy the rest of your week and you could take the kids there and you don't have to worry about the next game. I'm more glad that I don't have that, really, because it used to take me into dark places, football, sometimes. The competitiveness, how do I get that? Not really. No, I probably don't have that in some ways. I'm competitive with punditry, if I'm being honest. I watch every other show. I watch Match of the Day. I watch BT. I want to see what they're doing. What are they analysing? That's nonsense. Or that's good. But I can make it better. Or they touched on that. Oh, that sparks an idea for me. That So I've got Monday Night Football, Monday obviously, and I'll watch everything on TV over that weekend, and I see that as a challenge to be better than everyone else, whether it's my newspaper column, whether it's Monday, the analysis that I do, I have to make, that's my competitiveness now. I see Match of the Day, BT Sport as my challenge, not Everton or Manchester United.
How do you go about Monday Night Footy? Like, is it a stupidly early start, or are you working on it from as soon as the game starts on a Saturday? What's the process there, and how many people are involved?
Yeah, well, because Gary doesn't do it all the time now, it's me and the producer, and we've got a few stats, lads. So I've already been thinking about Monday Night Football now, a few days before. So I know the Sunday games, we're going to cover the Sunday games, no matter what happens, unless they're absolutely the worst games in the world. They're that big, you're going to cover them. Manchester Derby, Ancelotti going back to Chelsea. Mm. So you're going to look at that. I'm already thinking of something on Wolves, the way they're going. You know, he done an interview last week, so I read an interview by the manager that I thought was brilliant. Nuno, so it sparked a few ideas. I see, listen, they might get beat at the weekend, then you can't do something positive on them because they've lost in some ways. So they're playing Brighton, so fingers crossed Wolves win. I might look at that. Now, I might get into the meeting and there's that much other stuff. It mightn't work or it mightn't whatever. But we're always bouncing ideas off each other. I'll have watched something and you send something to the group chat. Can someone have a little look at this or check this out? Or I'll watch the Manchester Derby and I'll mark minutes of a clip that I've watched. Or I've seen something, but it won't be the goals.
No,
it'd be like someone done something strange on a goal kick. Why is he doing that? Why is he there? Or this has happened a lot in the game. Then I'll get to Sky. I either get the early train on Monday morning, 7 o'clock. Get to London for 9. I'll be in Sky 10, or I go the night before. So I'll be in Sky for 10. We'll have a meeting for an hour and a half. But we've all been on the group chat all beforehand, so you'll have an half an idea. Then you'll thrash things out. Then I'll go to the video room, and that's when you can look at a camera where you can see 22 players on a pitch and you spot other things that you won't have seen.
I'm a massive NFL fan, like, and I pay for NFL Game Pass, and they give you an all 22, so it's a view all the time, and then they always go to the how many downs and distance and all that is every play, so you know exactly what it is. It's so much better, and I just don't understand why they haven't given that to fans yet.
Well, I think on Monday Night Football, I think if you I don't know what it is, you press the red button or you do something, you can get the, well, you certainly could last season, you get what we watch. Now, we have a, on Monday Night Football, we'll watch, we've got about 3 TVs, so you've got the normal, what you're watching, and then there's a big screen where, when we're stood up at the table and you see the teams coming out or we do an interview, we'll have the full 22 players on that when the game's going on. So it just gives you a better view, and then you see things off the ball or by someone else. Like, perfect example was, I'd done a Man United game and Pogba first come, so it was Man U City as it was this weekend. I thought I was analysing something completely different. When I watched the clips, I went, this is a poor Pogba piece. So things can change through the day as well. So it's not like we get in and it's like, right, we're doing this. You can do, we do. So basically, we do the clips, then we'll go to the gym. We have a bit of lunch. We have an hour rest. Then we'll do a rehearsal at 3, 4 o'clock. That rehearsal could go badly. Or it's just, you just think, it's not working. It's not flowing. This is not right. And you might think, right, let's do something else. So sometimes it's like, you know, you're on the seat of your pants and something to that, and that's what makes it what it is.
Get the juices flowing, doesn't it? I think it's mad that because the last World Cup and the VR stuff on BBC, and you could watch, they had that wide angle, and you realise how much of football you miss on television coverage. I mean, for God's sake, look at the Liverpool Chelsea game. They missed the build up to the first goal because they were showing a replay of something that happened.
That's a big problem now, that when you do co-commentary. It's when can you get a replay? And years ago, as soon as the ball goes out, a goal kick was always going to be 20 seconds. Now, because of the goal kick rule, it's played short straight away, and a team can win it back. And before you know it, we nearly missed one this season. It was a Chelsea game. It was a goal kick. Someone passed it out. Mason Mount closed someone down. They won the ball, boom. And before you know it, we just got back on for the finish. And I'm then having to describe a goal that I haven't really seen because I'm looking at a monitor because I'm having to talk over a replay. And before you know it, you go, oop.
Shit,
go.
Yeah.
What's happened?
You're asking the question.
I'm then trying to describe. So straight away, co-commentaries, I love co-commentary now. Co-commentary is the one that no one says a nice word about. You're on co-commentary about anyone. No, they don't. Yes. No one's got a nice word to say about anything. You know, you go on social media. It doesn't bother me. But I love that more now than being in the studio on a Super Sunday. Not more than, Monday Night Football's the number one. But next on my list of what I do for Sky is co-commentary. that thing of being in the game, a goal happens, just reacting to things. You feel like you're in the crowd. When you're in a studio, you're almost cocooned from it. So sometimes I'll go back into the studio after a co-commentary, and you walk in the studio and you've been in a ground where it's bouncing and energy, and you come back and you go, kind of someone died.
boring bastards, come on. Yeah, what a game that was.
They're sort of, as I said, they're just almost not fully engaged in what's happened, really. So that's why I love co-commentary. Now, even though I probably get a lot of stick, just stay off your phone for an hour when you're doing a co-commentary.
Have you ever had, because obviously when you came into the Sky, and I, did you ever have a producer or whatever take you to one side in the early days and be like, Jamie, just... can you just talk a bit more slowly, or can you do us a favour? Can you
enunciate?
Pronounce things a bit more.
You never see Scousers on the telly, though, do you? Really?
No, I think it's mad, isn't it? Because I don't think twice about it, but it's amazing the amount of people who don't have access to Scousers on a regular basis. And you talk to them, and you can see them glaze over, like, what the fuck are they saying? Mm-hmm. What are they saying here? Did you have any Did you get pulled a couple?
No, but
of
I was aware of it going in. That I speak quickly, and even me, but my family will say to me, you've got a TV voice. You know, but I do sometimes think, slow down a little bit. And then sometimes I watch myself back and think, that's not me speaking, that's too slow.
Yeah.
Really, so I'm not really there now. But the first few shows I used to watch Monday Night Football back, I was told to watch it back, and you spot little things, or, you know, little things you say and what you do. And yeah, I got loads of, I didn't have any going in. People always say, do you have media training going into Sky? Nothing at all. I was just myself. But then obviously working with the best people, it's just like little points, be careful with that, or be careful with that, or like a couple of bits I was told, when you've got something big to say, because if I'm on a show for Monday Night Football for 4 hours, people only remember three or four things, and it's like, but you've got to know what those three or four things are, and it's almost, right, get you ready, right, bump, you know, but make sure you're in vision. There's no point saying something really big and there's a replay going on because you're not listening to what I'm saying, you're watching the replay.
Yeah.
It's like if you've got something really big to say, and just slow yourself down and make sure you get it out, and, you know, things like that. That was certainly a big thing, making sure when you've got something to say, make sure the camera's on, you don't waste it.
I genuinely love that you think it's the stuff I think about that all the time, and it's something that I've never actually thought about before, but it's right, isn't it? You know what I mean? You've got to make sure that the cameras are on you. That if you've got, if you want to, yeah, no, I think that's.
Do you get irritated when someone interrupts you? Because you look like you do.
Yeah,
you do. You can't hide it. Your face says it. Like,
yeah, I think it's rude. I don't interrupt other people.
I'm trying to make sure that I don't interrupt when I'm coming back on it.
But I would say is, I think there's an art to interviewing. Something that I'm learning now is that another piece of advice someone gave me when I went onto TV was, when you start speaking, know how you're going to finish. Because sometimes people just keep talking and they don't know how they're going to finish. And is that you? And you think, where am I going? And you just keep talking and you keep going. So when you're actually interviewing people, certainly for the podcast, you've almost got to wait for that little pause, bump, you've got to be in. Yeah. Because if you don't, they just think, oh, they want me to carry on talking. They just keep talking. And they're talking shite. So I think you can't interrupt someone, but when you're on TV and you know you want to come in with something, it's like you've almost never interrupt someone, but as soon as you have that pause, you've got to be in. And you've just got to get in. So it doesn't look like you've interrupted someone, but you're almost... I want to challenge him, or I've got another point, or we can take this somewhere else, or whatever it is.
What about Gary Neville then? I think he's come across like really, really good mates. Is that true?
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah. I mean, working together. I mean, listen, Stevie Gerrard, my biggest mate in football, I hardly ever see him. Yeah. No, because, you know, I'm with Gary Neville more than Stevie. You'd have thought that. You know, I probably text Gary Neville now more than Stevie Gerrard. Because something about the show or Sky or how you get in the game or whatever. That's just the way it is. It's like when you're in a football dressing room. All these people around the world, you see them more than sometimes some of your family. Because you just, that's the situation that you're in. But no, he's brilliant on TV, isn't he?
Yeah.
I think what makes it work is we're probably very similar in a lot of ways. And that we're both very passionate, we're very opinionated. Our opinion wouldn't sway. A lot of people on TV can be swayed. If someone doesn't agree with them, they think, oh, maybe they are right. Or whereas I think I believe in what I... So that's where the spark of a debate can come from. But I think a lot of the time we think pretty similar things because we've had the same sort of background. One club man, play for big clubs, passionate, really, you know what it's like playing at that level for so long. So we're pretty similar in a lot of the stuff that we do.
Did make each other better pundits, you reckon?
Yeah. That's what I like. I like new people pundits coming. I like Roy Keane coming in now. Someone challenging you. I want that.
But he's not a sheep. That's what you need in a pundit. You need someone who's not just going to follow someone else's opinions blindly.
But I like that thing. If someone challenges me, I've got to come back with something. I've got to think, oof, yeah, I didn't think of that. And I've got to come back with something else. But I want to do that to other people. So the best thing I think that works is when me or Gary are on co-commentary and we haven't been in the studio all day. And then we come in for the last half an hour. So sometimes you see Gary Neville joins me and whoever, and Graeme Souness, or maybe I just come in for the last half an hour. You've both seen the games from different angles. You've almost got different things, and you haven't been sat there for 6 hours, and you come in a bit fresh, and you're energetic, and you think, and sometimes you come in, I'll be totally honest, you come in and you go, it's a bit boring in here. And you just throw a bomb in. Just spark something. Yeah. Just go, why? Why has someone said that? And
I think there's a lot of lazy pundits. From my experience, I've worked with a lot of ex-pros doing shows, and I think there's an expectation, I think, where because you played the game, you know everything there is to know about the game. And I think there's a lot of people who, you know, have staunch opinions. I think when there's education behind it and there's thinking behind it, I think it's fine. But I think a lot of pundits are quite blinkered. They don't do the research. They come in, but they're very used to being everyone hanging off their every word because they won this or they won that. If you found that along the way as well, that's part of the challenge. You don't want to be. There's probably a lot of old school guys who maybe don't get as much work these days because there's guys like yourself and Neville who are coming in and raising the bar.
Yeah, listen, when I was a player, I didn't think punditry was great, and that's why I thought I could do punditry, because I thought there's not quite the detail there, really. I think Gary Neville brought that detail. I think social media now has given a voice to fans at every club where they're not idiots. I mean, I used to read the Liverpool fanzines, and you'd read them and think, yeah, these know what they're talking about, these lads, or whoever's writing these fanzines. And I think social media's given a voice and a platform to what yous do, bloggers, different things. So you can't get away with things now of just turning up and not doing research. But when you say research, I'm not going to come on here and say I know every single player in the Premier League and what he's done all season. Certainly at the smaller clubs. Now, that might offend the smaller clubs, but I watch everything on TV and I read papers. And more often than not, it's the teams at the top or the top players. Like, I don't need to do no research for Man United, Man City. I know every player. I know what they've been playing like. I know what the result, you know. So if you are doing a smaller team, or you will do more research. We get stat packs. You read everything on the stat pack. How have they gone in the last couple of games? You know, so you almost have to be more switched on for those games. But I can't sit here and say, I know everything. How many players the team sign now every season? 10 players from all over the world. You can't get across all of it, really. But you do as much as you can. And when you're going into a game, you know what you're going to be talking about. But the big thing for me is we've got to give our experience, but the game's always changing. And I never want to be one of those people who says, this was wrong. We did this in our day, and that was right. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with looking at your experience and now and again saying that. I'm not quite sure with this. The new goal kick rule is the perfect example, really. All these top managers can't be wrong if they're playing out from goal kicks like that. So I'm not going to say this is a joke. This is not right. We used to just kick it. Because that makes me look really old school as a pundit. It's like, I want to know why they're doing it. What are they actually gaining from it? What are they trying to do? Where are they trying to take it?
Well, for me anyway, and correct me if I'm wrong here, there's more space to defend with the new goal kick rule. And it's so much harder for a front two or a front three to defend the width of the pitch from the 6 yard box. So automatically, you've got the strikers with a bigger gap to the midfielders and the midfielders with a bigger gap to defenders. That's why I think Liverpool play a much higher line. And, you know, you might correct me if I'm wrong, but we're averaging the halfway line most of the games now, and we're pinning teams in, and that's how you're doing it. You're crushing.
Well,
I listened
to a podcast the other day. It was Zonal Mark, and
Michael
really
Cox,
good. And he had someone on talking about the goal kicker on the stats, where you've actually got 3 more chances of scoring if you play short. We've also got 3 more chances of conceding, really. But it's what you back yourself type of thing, that someone's on there looking at the stats. So basically, if you keep knocking it long, you're not going to concede from your goal kick, but you're probably not going to score from your goal kick or whatever. And it was just interesting listening to them and why teams do it, and who they were talking about, actually Gattuso and what he's doing in Napoli. Everton actually conceded the goal. I actually interviewed Carlo Ancelotti yesterday, and I spoke to him about what he was doing on goal kicks, because they conceded the goal from Pickford, the Fernandez shot, but it come from a goal kick. But actually, throughout that game, before that happened, Everton were really good on goal kicks. And it was just something in my mind. I'm commentating thinking, I could look on this on Monday Night Football. They kept getting out. It was coming into Gomez, and he was just one touch out to a fullback, and they were out. So even though they lost the goal, you might get Everton fans saying, just kick it long. But actually, as a manager, he's looking at it and thinking, OK, that was a mistake from Sidibe's pass. Keeper should have saved it. But actually, if you look at it, so that's what Monday Night Football is. Not saying the obvious. So a lot of people would say, oh, they should just kick it. But if we looked at all Everton's goal kicks, you'd say, look, the first four, they get out here and they're there. If he actually makes a better pass to Deeby. So that's what Monday Night Football is, I suppose.
There's a City one that they did a couple of times last year. I haven't watched much City this season because the gap's massive. but they like, every time there's a goal kick and someone's kicking it long, they always cramp into a 20-metre square on the pitch, give or take, and City don't do it sometimes. And I'm looking at it going, why are they doing that? Like, is it because they're smaller lads, maybe? They haven't got as much chance, or they back them to control it and get a pass out? That's the interesting stuff in footy that I enjoy, like.
I'll give you a good example of what we're talking about, though, that does my head in with punditry, and you mentioned the name of the podcast. Zonal marking has become this, like, term where I think pundits who don't understand to go, zonal marking, oh, well, we never play. I've heard so many times, well, we never used to play zonal marking. We always marked man to man. And you never hear enough. And you remember you doing something on it years ago. In fact, you got Lucas Leiva to explain the
Liverpool zonal marking
from corners. It was brilliant. Because no one was going, well, this is why they're doing it, because there's got to be a reason. You know,
I'm actually at the stage where I don't even get involved in that discussion now, because I've just torn my ear out that much about it, because I'm actually embarrassed for pundits and people and that. The best line that people come out with over zonal marking is, well, man-to-man marking's better because you know whose fault it is when the goal goes in. You're like,
oh, my God.
And I've heard managers say that, and I'm like, oh, it gives responsibility, so no one can say, oh, it wasn't my man. You're like, oh my God, that's unbelievable. Liverpool are doing something different. I noticed in Atletico Madrid, I noticed, and we conceded from the corner, and they've carried on doing it. So it might be something for us to look at. I'll check it again at the weekend.
Is it the bending of the players on the outswinger?
Yeah. You know, to start off to get your Monday Night Football. But almost normally zonal marking is you'd have players on the 6-yard box and you'd have players on the penalty spot. Whereas this seemed one line of almost like a diagonal, or you say it was a bend, but almost like one line of sort of 6-7. And you know what? In some ways, I'm probably thinking, I liked it because the outswing is, I used to always be at the near post or level with the near post. So an outswinger, you'd be able to get that. But the fella in the middle, the ball's already coming away from you, so it's hard to... So I actually liked the fact that it was almost like that. We can see the goal, Atletico Madrid. But I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's something new. Have they been doing it before?
Yeah, they've done it about 4 or 5 games now, I think. I reckon.
Well, I noticed it then. So was it... That's the first time I noticed it, and I thought... Well, that's all I do.
Makes sense, though, doesn't it? Yeah. You haven't got an 8-yard run if you're the back stick.
Exactly. So I actually thought it was a good thing, but we conceded from it. But some people then may say, oh, zonal marking. But I thought that was a good thing. So
I love it. I genuinely love that thing. I guess you're right. It's balmy because you've just got people who are set in the ways and they're limited to understand. It's that old Arrigo Sacchi thing, isn't it, about saying, like, you don't want it, if you want to be a jockey, you don't have to have been a horse first. You've got to understand. Having a deeper understanding, if it doesn't require you to... Of play, because there's loads of footballers who will just turn up and do the job. They'll have done what they're told for so long. But I think the man marking thing's boss because, and what I mean is, because it, you're right, it's the blame thing. So much of football analysis is just men sat in a studio telling you who's wrong and who was shit that day, and not enough of going, well, this is what was good. This is what was done right. There's so much miserable football analysis. Because people don't know what to say, it's like genetically bred into football, football TV to go, well, it's shit. Well, why is it shit? Well, it's shit because it's shit, because I don't understand it. And I must admit, I like, that's probably why everyone gets banged on about Monday Night Football, because again, you've got a great camaraderie, but you're also prepared to, people come out knowing more about the game.
And that's like if I listen to a podcast or if I watch something on the telly, I want to come out like not like wasting a fucking hour of my day. Because you don't have that much time
in
your day.
I've started listening to podcasts because I can't listen to the radio anymore. I'm just listening to radio and I'm just bored. I'm just listening to just nonsense. So I actually put a podcast on now on the way to the gym, or if I'm taking my son to football, 40 minutes. I love the Totally Football show. I listen to that. Because they're talking about, it's like, whether you agree with it or not, when you get out the car, you think, I've learned something or of interesting. Yeah. That was it. Or you said about him or that team, or I didn't know that about that team or system they were playing us, rather than just listening to just nonsense on the radio.
And ultimately, you know, we've not got your phone and talk sport in to put people right anymore. Yeah.
That might have been one of my highlights of your entire career, was the moment where you kind of. Absolutely fantastic. Right, we're going to, I think we, well, there's actually one thing I want to ask before we start to wrap up. Just about the coaching and managing thing, is it something you think you'd ever consider in the future? Or, and I often wonder whether, because you work so closely with Gary Neville, does him going to Valencia and not working out, is that entered your thinking as well at any point? Because obviously, I guess you don't really consider failure, but when you've got someone who's that close to you, who's had that opportunity and it not worked, is that something that would put you off?
I don't think, even if him going there and doing well, would have thought, oh, I want to be a manager or stuff like that. I think, listen, I'm not bad at what I do. This might be what I was meant to do. I might not be a good manager. I think my knowledge of the, I think I could sit in a room with Pep Guardiola, Ancelotti, Jurgen Klopp around his table, and I wouldn't feel out of place talking football. That I'm not saying that in an arrogant way. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know more than them. But I think I could challenge, I could add something different, you know, I could speak in my opinion and I could understand what they were saying on a system or a formation. My problem would be a manager would be dealing with players. It would be. Now, managing players, that's what it's about. And basically, I probably wanted to win too much when I was a Liverpool player. And I know not everyone's like that, but how would I be able to deal? I'm not sure I could deal with players not wanting to win as much as me. That'd keep me up at night. And the way I look at it, I think, you know what, I'm all right just managing my kids. You know, the couple of kids, that'll do me. And no one else is in my life who I've got to worry about, or what's he doing, or his agent trying to move him on and stuff like that. And I just look at that. And to be honest, it looks like hassle to me.
That's true. Well, one final question for me, Jamie. I think, you know, Liverpool are on the verge of winning the Premier League for the first time in 30 years. Obviously, as a fan, you're going to be absolutely made up. Is there a part of you that wishes or is jealous in any way that it wasn't you and your teammates?
I wouldn't say I'm jealous. I mean, I'm just, do I wish I won the league? Yeah, of course. I feel completely different now than when I did when the Brendan Rodgers team was nearly winning, because I was looking at that team thinking I could still be involved here. So that was where I was torn a little bit, where I was like, oh my God. You know, my son's made up, everyone's buzzing.
And they're all your mates as well, aren't they?
Yeah, these players. And I'm actually looking at some players in that squad and thinking, they're going to have a league on the medal and they're not that good. You know what I mean? After having 17 years and we all wanted the league. So I was a bit like, oh God, this is, oh no. But now I'm absolutely, because I know I can't play in that team. I'm 42. Yeah. You know what I mean? It was almost like the first team, you're thinking, the club wanted me to stay as well. I knew I could still play. Cole O'Toole had come in and took my place. He wasn't a regular in the team, but I could have easily have done that. And you think, oh, everyone's just going to say, oh, remember the year you left, you won the league? But it was all because everyone around me was buzzing. My son was over the moon. I'm thinking, oh, my God. So you're half happy, especially for Stevie, but half thinking, oh, what have you done? Yeah, what have you done? But now I'd say it's completely different, and I'm like a fan, or obviously I'm on Sky at the moment. But I get battered all the time on social media now for, oh, you're biased to Liverpool, you're biased. I'm not. I just say to them, what can you say negative about Liverpool? They've lost two games in fucking 2 years in the league. It's unheard of what Liverpool are doing. There's nothing you can say. I mean, I was very critical of Liverpool towards the end of Brendan Rodgers' time, critical of the owners when they put ticket prices up, lots of different, when Stevie went leaving, letting Stevie go to America, lots of different things. But right now, it possibly can't get better for a Liverpool fan. European champions, world champions, about to win the Premier League. Losing one game a season, even the greatest Liverpool teams would lose 5 or 6 games in a season. Yeah. It's just, you know, there's been no better time to watch Liverpool and be part of Liverpool.
Just the one thing I've got to ask, because everyone wants to know, Steven Gerrard, has he got, I mean, I don't say has he got, what does he need to do, do you think, between now and whenever Klopp leaves or whatever, to be the guy, to be the right guy for Liverpool?
I'm not sure if he needs to do another job beforehand as well. I think Rangers to Liverpool is a jump because he's Steven Gerrard and he's who he is. I think he could make that jump. The club wouldn't be too big for him, let's put it that way, really. Is managing Rangers enough experience for Liverpool? Should Liverpool be looking for the best manager they can possibly get, or thinking we've got someone who knows the club. I think that could be a conundrum for the club at the time. And also Stevie, because I look at, I've always thought this, Stevie's gone into management, where at the back of it, he wants to manage Liverpool. Frank Lampard's gone into management because he wants to manage Chelsea.
Yeah.
John Terry's the same, gone into coaching. Thierry Henry started to manage because he wants to manage Arsenal. It's not like they want to be managers for 30 years. They just want to manage their club. And I always think, are you best managing your club when you're at your peak of your powers as a manager, or you just want to manage? So Frank Lampard, I think, is doing a really good job.
Yeah.
But no one can tell me that Frank Lampard wouldn't be a better manager in 10 years' time. And that's what was my always feeling about managing. You're only going to get one chance at it. You want it to go well. That's what you're going to, that's what's going to define your managerial career. For Gerrard at Liverpool, Lampard at Chelsea, even if he goes to other clubs and he's done well at Derby, it's the Chelsea job. And I sometimes, my criticism's the wrong word. I done a column at the start of the season saying, I hope it goes well for Frank, but in some ways I wish he was coming in 5 years' time, 6 years' time, where he's just got that experience. Look at Stevie now, what he's going through. Just lost a game to the bottom of the league.
13 points behind now as well.
Yeah, but lost to Hamilton at home. And I sent him a text last night because I knew he'd be devastated. I know myself when you've had a bad result. And you're just like, oh my God. And I knew how he'd feel. But that'll help him in years to come. That'll help him for the Liverpool job. So he's got to go through all these, doing really well in Europe, getting to a final with Rangers, probably being unlucky in the final. That's an experience. Losing to bottom of the league. That'll help him all the time in his managerial career. But he'll be able to deal with it better. And as I said, the Liverpool job, you want him to get it when he feels like, right, I've got that much experience. And something happens, I've been there before. Yeah. I've done it before. And that's my only hope. And it's whether, after Rangers, he takes another job in the Premier League, maybe a smaller club in the Premier League, and then maybe gets the Liverpool job. Or, you know what? It's right for him right now. It works. And that's the decision for both parties.
I think you see it, don't you? You see it in, like, there's a reason why 19-year-olds don't dominate at centre-half. And young goalkeepers don't do it because they're positioned, and like manager, where you're right, the more you play and the more experience you've got, the more you've got answers. It's not like when you're centre forward and you need to just be, it helps to be fast and it helps to just be brave and you know, and whatever. But they're the things where you're right.
And also people not to know, it helps as a striker.
Here's a good example. Playing centre back, Watford, Lovren. I've watched Lovren in a Liverpool shirt for so long, making the same mistake. And what I mean by that is, he wants to fight everybody he plays against. Now, I always remember when I was about 18 or 19, I played for Liverpool away at Aston Villa. And in your head, you're a centre-half. When the other team take a goal kick, I win the header. But their keeper's hitting it into midfield, and David Thomo's winning headers. David Thompson was playing that day. But I'm like, that's not right, I should be winning the header. So I'm actually trying to knock people out the way to go and win a header. But... And Ronnie Moran said to me after, What are you doing? It doesn't matter who. And that's a little thing that always stuck with me. Yes, that is my job, if you like, but it's working for us. Stay there. Now, Lovren, you're playing against Troy Deeney. I played against Drogba probably more than any other striker. And at times he was brilliant against us, but at times we really controlled him. And he didn't score that many goals against Liverpool. But I never took him on physically. It was a mismatch. But I get someone in front, you'd have to use your brain. You'd actually talk to Drogba through the game. And he almost become like a bit of a mate, you know, because you don't want to wind Drogba up for the game. But Troy Deeney can't be bullied. You can't, but maybe Van Dijk could. But that's why Troy Deeney stands on Lovren. Harry Kane, the start of this season, stands on Lovren. Every time the ball comes, just uses his body, knocks him out the way. That's what I'm saying about a centre-half. But he's 28.
Yeah.
He should have learned that by now, that there's nothing wrong. It's not weak by saying... Not a problem. My son's a centre back. I say, watch that game, right? There's no problem with letting Troy Deeney bring the ball down. Because Troy Deeney brings the ball down and holds it up and it's good play by him, doesn't mean it's bad play by the centre back. Sometimes you have to say, well done. But just get Fabinho in front on the next one. You see the throwing? How tight he is to him.
And he's holding him.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, he just doesn't smell, understand. It's like he's got this thing where he can't, he must feel it's weak. To let Troy Deeney win the fight. No, he's not winning the fight. Make sure Liverpool win the game. Make sure he doesn't score. Whether he brings the ball down on the halfway line. The one where Trent knocks it back for the back pass, he's climbing over, falling over him. Heads it, falling over. Trent does the back pass. But it's 40 yards from goal. If Troy Deeney brings that down, he's only going to play back. Okay, he's good at that. Don't worry about it. And that's the thing that you learn with centre back, and you have to learn with that experience. But he's an experienced player and hasn't learned, and that's his biggest problem.
It's mad, isn't it? The best example, I think, just on the management thing, is it's Brendan Rodgers. I think when you get to Liverpool, you shouldn't be doing your learning on the job. I think when you get to that level, and I think that was what Liverpool were at that time. I think FSG, look, I think it was a noble ambition of what they were trying to do. Brendan, exciting coach, certainly. But I think the reason why lots of Liverpool fans didn't get on with him and the notion of him is because we're so used to everything being there and being ready, and that's the difference in Klopp, isn't it? He doesn't know all the answers, and he'll say himself,
he's got
40 I don't know
all. Years experience.
But exactly. But he's got enough answers to enough problems that he'll work stuff out. Whereas when you hear stories of Brendan Rodgers pacing around his kitchen at 3 o'clock in the morning and it comes up with three at the back, and you're like, oh, that's a great story, but no one needs to hear that. Everyone wants to know that the Liverpool manager knows what
I think Brendan Rodgers would be a brilliant Liverpool manager in the future. It won't happen because he's had his go. I think Brendan Rodgers would be a brilliant Chelsea manager, Arsenal manager. If I was those clubs, I'd be looking at them if they change the manager in the future, no doubt about it. I think Brendan Rodgers should get a crack at one of the Champions League clubs in this country. I've said for a long time, Brendan Rodgers is the best British manager out there. Mm-hmm. You actually look at the things he's done and the experience he's had at Liverpool. Talking about Steven Gerrard. What Brendan went through at Liverpool at times, the great season, just missing out, in not going well, buying, selling, all the things he learned is helping him now at Leicester, going to Celtic, then winning, being in cup finals, and you know the tension on the day, how you deal with that. I think Brendan Rodgers would be a brilliant manager. But as you said, that's probably something for Stevie in the future. Get all that experience, or as much as you can possibly get. It's difficult because it's not like the Liverpool job comes around. Sometimes it's just time and it's there, you're available, and you say, well, you know what, I might not get another chance, I'm going to have a go at it. But I think in a perfect world, you'd be... When those big jobs come around, you want to be fully ready.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Jamie, for taking the time to come in. Always a pleasure, mate. And make sure you go and check out The Greatest Game podcast. Some absolute belters on there. And now we know a new series coming in September onwards.
September,
that exclusive? World exclusive?
Yeah.
It's right.
Who do you want on?
Ooh. Robbie.
Roy Keane. Ewan Keane. That would be brilliant.
That would be interesting, actually. Roy Hodgson.
The Roys?
See if you can can convert Liverpool fans to liking Roy Hodgson after an hour.
We suffered the Michael, yeah.
Xavi?
Pardon?
Could you get Xavi?
I've already texted Xavi about the safe face, so we probably have to go over to Suárez to see him. But what you don't want to do is make it fully... Listen, my contacts are more Liverpool people, and the people who listen to the show are probably more Liverpool supporters. So in some ways, it's got to be Liverpool heavy than other clubs. But we haven't had a Man United guest on yet. I didn't want to get Gary in the fair because that would be too obvious. Trying for Rio Ferdinand, he's agreed to do it. It's just getting a date, so that could be one in the future. I'm working on Michael Laudrup.
Oh wow!
Who does a bit of work with us on foreign TV, so he's hard to quite pin down or whatever. So they are working on different things, really. But it'll always be two or three Liverpool people because they're my contacts, and they're what probably most of the listeners want to probably listen to.
What about
to.
Someone who like started this like a Klinsmann or a Viali or someone who was in there at the influx of the Premier League and players from abroad coming in or something like that? I'd love to listen to Klinsmann talk about footy because he's had the managerial stuff now as well.
I actually tried to get Klinsmann on Monday Night Football a couple of years ago. I got his email off someone who was trying to get him when Tottenham were doing really well. Tottenham were nearly winning the league. It didn't quite. I think he was the America coach. Yeah. I think at the time didn't quite work getting him on or something. So I'll check if he's still got the email.
Pochettino.
Yeah, could be a good one.
Find out about Klinsmann nearly replacing Rafa. That'd be an interesting one. But the good thing is, timing-wise, you'll have James Bond for that around the time. For the
maybe, yeah. Maybe I'll get Daniel Craig and that would be a good one. Yeah, that'll spark an idea. Well,
absolutely quality. Well, make sure you go over and check out all the... You probably have already. They're outstanding. But yeah, of course, do that. And stay tuned for a little insight into Monday Night Football and all that. But listen, thanks very much for watching and for listening. Make sure you subscribe. If you want to check us out, it's at Majax Pajax on Twitter and on Instagram as well. And we'll be back with more next week.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.